Welcome to the second part of the series, What is Human Being? Problems of Anthropology. Today I'm not in the best form, I have to admit, because I stayed awake almost the whole night with a minor, so excuse me when I'm a bit tiresome or so. Today we want to deal with a specific part of anthropology, with theological anthropology, or to say it in different words, how can Christians, with the background of the Bible, contribute to an understanding of humanity? In the first session, we dealt mainly with the problems of the science, of a scientific approach to understand humanity and to understand what the human being is. And we brought up a variety of problems and difficulties the science about humanity has today and in the past. I don't want to repeat all that. Theological anthropology, or the Christian understanding of humanity, has some specific problems which are different from the problems scientific on the anthropology of the natural sciences has. And we want to deal with that today. We want to deal with the second point with which I start, that is the problem, how can theology and natural science work together at all? But that is a problem which is a very new problem. It only arose in the time after the Enlightenment, and we will deal why that is, why after the Enlightenment there began a separation between theology and natural sciences. And the third point we want to do tonight is that we look at one specific anthropology of one pretty famous theologian, Martin Luther, to see how theological anthropology can work. First of all, the problem of a theological anthropology. Why are there specific problems in a theological anthropology? Why has theology to deal with humanity at all? You could say theology, as the word says, is the science about God and not the science about humanity. But from the very beginning on, the existence of God was always understood in relation to creation and in relation to humanity. And therefore, beside God, humanity was always a topic in religious understanding of the world. So theology deals not only with God, but deals with God in connection with the world and humanity. Why is that problematic today, and where are advantages of a theological anthropology today? The problem is that since the Enlightenment, as I mentioned, there is a separation of theology and natural science. There's a famous interview by a Nobel Prize winner, I think he was a physicist, who answered a question, the question of a journalist, do you believe in God? Of course not, I'm a scientist. And that is an expression not of the whole field of natural science, but an expression of a certain understanding of the truth in natural science. And this understanding of the truth is the understanding that truth is only what can be objectified. Truth is only what can be proved in experiment, what can be measured. True things are only those things I can touch. It is very interesting that the German word for understanding is begreifen, that means to touch. To understand something means to touch it, to take it into your hand. And that is a very important approach for modern natural science, which has a lot of difficulties too, because unfortunately, human beings tend not only to touch things, but to destroy things by touching them. And therefore, this approach of understanding the truth as only objectifying things is at least an approach which can be questioned. In philosophy, you call this attitude positivism. And there were quite a lot of natural scientists and philosophers who declared openly that they are positivist. That means only to speak about truth makes only sense if I can prove the truth, to say it a bit simplified. One of the most important books about positivism, or one of the most important programs of positivism, is the book by Wittgenstein, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and he said, whereabout we cannot speak, we should be silent. That sounds a bit funny, but what he wants to say is, there are certain things which make no sense for human brains. There are certain things we cannot explain, and about these we shouldn't speak even, because it makes no sense to speak about it. We should concentrate on those things we understand. And that's the only thing human beings should do. I don't want to discuss if Wittgenstein or the late Wittgenstein is a positivist or not. That's not very important, but I think the point is important to get what positivism means. That means that the only truth which is relevant and important to us is the truth we can prove in a scientific, and that means in an experimental way. But that is not the standpoint of natural science in the whole area of natural science. There are scientists who have quite a different approach toward truth and toward the problem of truth. For one famous example is Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, a philosopher and nuclear physicist, or another famous German scientist, Homer von Ditfurth, who wrote a lot of understandable books for the public. It's very hard to read Weizsäcker sometimes, but Homer von Ditfurth is very popular in Germany because he is able to express things understandable. Before the separation of theology and natural sciences, or even of philosophy and natural sciences, because some kind of philosophies are not regarded as sciences by the positivists. Before that, we had a combination of theology and science. There was no separation. The big attempts from in the Middle Ages, Thomas von Aquino is the most famous example, was to construct a system in which everything is explained, from God to the lowest creature. Everything is in this system. That was a big attempt of the Middle Ages to construct a whole worldview which would contain both sides, the creation and God, both sides in one worldview. And Thomas von Aquino used mainly Aristotle, the Greek philosopher Aristotle, to understand the world and how the world works. And very famous are the proofs of God. Thomas von Aquino thought that God can be proved. Not, and that is important to know, not because there was any doubt about the existence of God. The existence of God had not to be proved because there were people who did not believe in God, but because of the connection of creation and the divine. Therefore, it was necessary for Thomas von Aquino to combine these both things in the proofs of God. And as you all know, the big destruction of this worldview, of this last attempt in the world to understand God and the creation together, was done by Immanuel Kant in the Enlightenment, when he showed clearly that the proofs of God do not work for a critical reason. The famous work of Kant is a critique of the critical reason. Why is that problematic for theology? Because theology then fought an endless fight for integrating the theological truth and the theological thinking in the worldview of people. And that was very difficult because it seems to be that theology had to go step by step back. They always discovered things which made theology to find new theories about the connection between God and world. And it was a very painful and very difficult way for theology to understand itself as a science, and to understand itself as something, as a knowledge which is important for the understanding of the world and God. And it led, till the 19th century, there was one step back after another, and it led in the 19th century to an attitude where theology or theologians thought the only thing they have to contribute to the understanding of the world is providing people with a kind of ethics. Maybe you remember the three questions by Kant. So theology dealt only with the problem, what shall we do, what should we do? The problem of ethics. That was the attitude of theologians in the 19th century. And the whole theology lost contact to interpret our world and reality in connection with theological understanding. And that that was a way for theology which was not very good for theology, because it led exactly to the schizophrenic understanding of many people nowadays who think they are Christians and have enormous problems to combine their Christianity with what they learn in school, with what they learn at universities, to combine their religious belief with scientific results of research. That is a big problem for the church in East Germany, for example, where the whole science, the whole scientific world research is openly declared atheistic. But it is as well a problem in the Western world, because like the famous philosopher Laplace, who explained to Napoleon the First his understanding of the world, and Napoleon asked him, where's God in your system? And he said, I don't need this hypothesis for my system. As this Laplace in the 18th century, scientists today work scientifically without the hypothesis of God. They cannot argue in their experiments, here is God. God is on this part placed in the experiment. That's impossible. That is not how science works. And what theology has to learn is to understand its task in front or in view to this work of science. And that is especially a task for theological anthropology. How did theology react on this challenge in the 20th century today? There are three ways to react on this. The one act is to try to accept the challenge. One very famous theologian, one famous German theologian, obviously Germans are very self-centered too, not only Americans, because most the most theology I learned from Germans. We don't read much English theology. That's sometimes very bad, because I think we need to get influence and new ideas from other parts of the world. But it is still the case that theology is mainly done in Germany, the main line of theology. So there are probably theologians in America who go in the same directions, but I can only give you the German names, I'm sorry. So Wolfhard Pannenberg would be a theologian who tried to accept this challenge by modern sciences, and he tried to develop a theology which would involve the results of modern science into the system of theology. His latest book, it is translated into English, is Anthropology. Anthropology in Theological Perspective. And it's no wonder that he chose particularly anthropology to do this approach of accepting the challenge of modern science in theology. The second way to deal with this problem is to the reluctance to admit the problem, or just to say that's not our problem, we don't deal with that. That is especially done by the so-called fundamentalists, who just refuse, who are saying theology has not to deal with this question, we don't care about modern science. Modern science is maybe something bad or something wicked or atheistic. We don't deal with that. We just have the Bible and believe in the Bible, and that's enough for our understanding of the world. I do it a bit like a caricature. You have this word? I don't want to judge by describing it, that I try to describe the attitude first. And we have to decide, or everybody of you has to decide, which approach is suitable for yourself. The third way, it's a way which was mainly tried by Karl Barth and his school, that he tried to explain that theology has a certain understanding of the truth which is not automatically compatible with the understanding of the truth of modern sciences. And he tried to develop certain rules for theology as a reasonable science, but as an independent and different science, different from all other sciences. But this approach and this attempt is in danger in two directions. The one direction is to lose contact with the challenging problems of our world. And these challenging problems are the problems of modern science. And the problems are realized in modern science. And if theology puts itself on an isolated standpoint, then it can lose very easily contact to the problems of our world. Another problem of this approach is that by modern scientists it is often accused as a kind of immunization strategy, that theology just constructs their own rules and says that the truth of theology does not fit to the truth of modern sciences. And that makes a discussion or a talk between the two very difficult. If they use just a different language, if they use just different systems. So I think Whereas one agrees with Pannenberg or not, obviously attempts to do a theology in communication with modern sciences. We have to do that. We have to do that as Christians. We have to stop our schizophrenic attitude towards the world and toward our belief. Our belief has something to do with things going on in the world, and our belief has something to do with the reality of the world. And therefore it is good that we understand reality better and better. And maybe theology has the task in this variety of sciences to make clear that the truth is not only what I can grab, but the truth is much more as we can measure by scientific methods and by scientific experiments. There is a beginning of a dialogue between modern sciences and theology. I mentioned already the name of Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker. And among theologians, it is sometimes difficult. One reason for that is that modern sciences are so complex that it's very difficult to understand what's going on in physics, in medicine, in microbiology, and all that stuff, genealogy. There are so many things which are all very interesting, but hard to follow for a single person. So that's a very challenging task for theology, and therefore it is so needed that there is a dialogue between scientists who know their field and theologians who know about theology. That is the thing theologians should do. There have been always attempts in theology in our century. Famous name is Teilhard de Chardin, famous name is Karl Heim, never much mentioned in theological literature, but he was the one who tried to establish a dialogue between modern physics and theology. And maybe the most popular is Hans Küng in Germany, who wrote the book Does God Exist? And that is a book which mainly tries to deal with the challenge of modern sciences towards theology and try to develop in theological approach to react on this challenge. One can discuss if that is very well done or not by Hans Küng, but that's not the problem. The problem is the way we have to do theology. Maybe I skip all that stuff, that's not so important. Maybe there are any questions right now, because that is I want to make that would be the first part today about the problem of science and theology, and I would go now then to specific anthropology. But maybe there are questions or remarks or disapprovements and so on. Well, first of all, there are no silly questions, but only silly answers. That I learned that in school, and I think that's very good. And this particularly is a very challenging question. What is the task of theology? There are a lot of people who say theology has no task. You can just forget it. I think, and I use a term of the theologian Karl Heim, whom I mentioned before, I think that our reality is not one-dimensional, but is polydimensional. There are many dimensions of reality. And modern science deals only with one certain dimension of the reality. And the task of theology would maybe be just to make people aware of this situation, that there is truth beside scientific experiments, and that there is more needed in understanding of the world than just understand how processes work. And that would be the task of theology. And you could just call it to try to understand the world in front or in relation to God as the source of the world, as a containment of the world, and as a future of the world.
One of the questions that come up when you talk about science and then about theology or about God, and that's the whole question of divine revelation, like through the written word. We can see it in creation all around here, but the whole idea about the Bible, the scriptures, as God's revelation. And I guess the thing that maybe bothers me sometimes is that we sometimes seemingly make an attempt to make that say what we would like it to say.
And
You see what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
And so that sort of leaves out the whole idea of the kind of a special kind of thing that God comes to reveal.
That is very interesting. The question was about the problem of revelation, and it is interesting that the development to atheism went through an understanding of revelation only by nature. Yeah, especially in the Enlightenment. God is in nature, and God reveals God's self in nature and through creation. And the whole problem of Jesus and the special revelation of God in Jesus was a very big problem for the theologians of the Enlightenment, because it was acceptable for people in this time to believe in a creator, but not to believe in a God who became man, who became human. And it's kind of interesting that today we have a reverse situation, because Jesus is a person, and that Jesus is a kind of divine person, whatever that may mean, is more acceptable for people today than to believe in a creator. It's very interesting that we have a reverse situation in this development. But, I mean, to speak about revelation could fill weeks.
Yeah.
I'm not prepared to say much about Weizsäcker. Weizsäcker is a nuclear physicist, and he was aware that the problem of modern physics are not only to be resolved by the means of modern physics, but he claimed the need for a special philosophical and theological interpretation of the results of modern sciences. And therefore, he became more or less a philosopher, beside his being a natural scientist. And he tried to work very hard on a dialogue between theology and natural science. And he said that theology has to learn that there is a particular need in natural science for a contribution of theology, how to understand the results of natural sciences. And therefore he urged theologians to be more open, to try to involve the problems of modern sciences in their work. Is that enough?
We always, keep coming up to saying that, well, natural science is something that's provable, is rational.
Mm-hmm.
But natural science without God, nothing cannot come from nothing. Therefore, to say that there is no natural science, to say there is no God, is totally irrational.
The question is if natural science, or the statement was that natural science cannot say that there is no God, and that is true.
Well, it's being irrational to say.
Or if they would say it, yeah.
Cannot come from nothing cannot come from nothing.
Right. If they would say, I have to repeat it for the tape, if they would say there is no God, it would be irrational, and I agree with that. And most natural scientists don't do that. This example I gave was a very particular example of modern scientists. Modern scientists say, for our work, we don't need the hypothesis of God. We don't work with God in our science. The question, if there is a God or not, is not decided by our methods, and we are not interested in that. And it goes so far that, like Wittgenstein, scientists say, we cannot solve this problem, therefore we don't want to speak about that. And it would make no sense to speak about it, because that is not meaningful in the words and in the methods we can use to speak about reality. That would be... To say there is no God is not the big deal for scientists. Yeah, that would be another worldview, which is as well improvable, improvable as the theism or the statement that there is a God. It would be very interesting to discuss Teilhard. He's a very interesting theologian and philosopher. It's sometimes hard to separate philosophy and theology. I don't think that... the special point in Teilhard, as far as I understand him, I agree totally that it's very hard to understand Teilhard, is that the person of Jesus plays a very important role in this development to the so-called point X, or to the omega, which is the goal of the whole evolutionary process. It is a very future-oriented philosophy, a very eschatological philosophy. Eschaton is the understanding of the things the world goes to, the future, the end of the world, or whatever. The problem I have with Teilhard is that he seems to be very anthropocentric, and he tries to understand the whole reality only concentrated to the consciousness, which is the human being is understood as the highest development of consciousness, and this consciousness will develop farther on to the point omega, to the, well, whatever that is, I don't know. And that seems to be not very helpful today. That was maybe helpful in the beginning of our century or in the middle of our century. Today we have to learn much more what we were talking about yesterday, that humanity is related to creation, to the whole creation, and that maybe humanity is not the only reason for creation. But I talked with one of you, I don't remember who it was, during lunchtime. There's an interesting development in modern astrophysics that it seemed to be that the whole reality we know about from the very beginning on, from the very 1,000th second of the Big Bang in the beginning, seem to work for the possibility of humanity. It's very fascinating. It's called the entropic principle. Entropic principle, and scientists find out that if there would any change in the first second of how they understand the beginning of the cosmos, if there would be slight differences in how it worked, then humanity would be impossible, and all things seem to work to make the whole development in cosmogony work to make humanity possible. I don't understand much. I don't know much about astrophysics, but it's a very interesting and challenging and fascinating point and view. Yes,
because Teilhard is a favorite of mine. I might enlighten you a little bit on that question.
Okay.
Isn't there some place in the New Testament where the disciples were making a big noise for Jesus,
And some people said, tell your disciples to be quiet. And he said, well, I tell you, if they were quiet, the very stones would speak up.
Right.
Or something like that. And I think Teilhard sees that the moral law that Jesus proclaims is so much a part of things that if you talk about it, you're talking about Jesus. Does that seem to make it more, Teilhard more accessible? He's got lots of books, and I think they're excellent. I mean, they're Christian.
Yeah, I don't agree with the troubles he had in the Catholic Church. I mean, the Catholic Church did not a very good job to put pressure on him. But that's always the tendency of all churches, that they have problems to accept new ideas or the new formulation of ideas in the understanding of the world and theology. But we cannot discuss Teilhard now. Would be interesting, but that's maybe a good topic for another series in Holden. Maybe I could, because we are again running out of time, it's terrible. Maybe I speak a bit about anthropology, and I have to speak about Luther because I promised that, and I will do that because Luther is my favorite theologian. I skipped the whole problem of development of anthropology in theology. I only mentioned that it's quite interesting that I would say one of the first theologians who has been at the same time anthropologist without knowing it was Augustine. His most famous and most important book in his theology was the Confessions, a kind of biography. So he tried to understand God and the world in understanding himself. And nothing else is anthropology than that we understand ourselves in our relation to God. And therefore I think Augustine was an anthropologist, a theological anthropologist. There are two points where anthropology is important in theology. The one point is the Christology, and we cannot speak about that much today. The problem how we understand the relation of divine and humanity in the person of Christ. That means we have to understand humanity and we have to understand the divine if we want to understand Christ as a divine human. The other thing which is where anthropology is important in the system of theology is the doctrine of creation. And the one famous term with which Christian theology tries to understand humanity is that humans are created in the image of God. Humans as the image of God. That is maybe a theological definition of human beings. Martin Luther did not write much about anthropology, and he never developed any system. He was not a systematic theologian. Some people really regret that, but I think it is very good and helpful that he wasn't a systematic theologian, because systematic theologians always tend to put everything into the system and make everything fit into the system, and therefore they are often very limited in their understanding of the world and reality. Martin Luther did some writing on anthropology, but not very much, but there is one famous writing, only 4 pages in the work of Luther, the Disputation Concerning Man from 1536. The other source for anthropology of Luther is the lecture about Genesis. Martin Luther was mainly an Old Testament scholar, and he held a very important lecture about the book of Genesis, and in this lecture he explained a bit his understanding of humanity. What is main thing he is saying about humanity. And as the title of this this part of the series today says, man is justified by grace. That is Martin Luther's definition of humanity, and that sounds to be very strange at the first moment. That is not a definition we would expect about man, about humanity. How comes Luther to say that in Caesar 32 he is saying, we hold that a man is justified by faith apart from works, briefly sums up the definition of man, saying man is justified by faith. And he not only says that is a theological definition of man, but he says that theology, to be sure, from the fullness of its wisdom, defines man as whole and perfect. So he does not only say that this is a particular definition of humanity, but he says that is the only definition which can understand humanity wholly and fully. That sounds maybe a bit arrogant or whatever, but in the first thesis, the first 19 thesis, he deals really with the philosophical approach to understand humanity. And Caesar first says, philosophy or human wisdom defines man as an animal having reason, sensation, and body. That is, we spoke about that yesterday, the classical definition of man as anima rationale, or the animal with reason. And he says that it is certainly true that reason is the most important and the highest rank among all things, and in comparison with other things of this life, the best and something divine. Reason is something divine for Luther. That is very important to remember, because Lutheran theologians always tend to underestimate the possibilities of reason. They are always saying reason is limited, and reason does not lead to God, only faith leads to God. That is not the standpoint of Luther. Luther says reason is something almost divine. It is the best thing we have as human beings. The most important thing, the thing which makes us to humans in the philosophical definition. And you can read in the whole 19 thesis that he does not only approve this definition, but he thinks that is the best definition humans can reach by their own knowledge, by their own possibilities. And he said, and that is important, that even after the fall, God did not take away this majesty of reason, but rather confirmed it. Even after the fall, this dignity, this divinity of humanity is confirmed by God. So reason is something very important for Luther and is very highly regarded. But then he says that when we compare philosophy or reason itself with theology, it will appear that we know almost nothing about man. Why is that so? Why can he said in the first thesis, reason is the most divine, the highest thing we always have, and then if we compare reason with theology, we realize that we know almost nothing about humanity? Because philosophy does not know the efficient cause for certain, nor likewise the final cause. Because it posits no other final cause than the peace of this life, and does not know that the efficient cause is God the Creator. I cannot explain, we have no time for this, the problem of the causes that has to do with Aristotelian philosophy. What Luther is saying is, maybe reason can know everything about how life functions. And that is what natural sciences are doing, to find out how life, how the cosmos is functioning. But what philosophy cannot know, what reason cannot know, is where everything comes from and where everything goes to. The so-called causa finalis and the causa originis. Where we come from and where we go to. And Luther said, whatever we know about humanity, whatever we know about how we function and how the world functions, if we don't know where we come from and we don't know where we go to, we know almost nothing about ourselves. And that is exactly the task of theology, to say where we come from and where we go to. And therefore, in Caesar's 19th, he finished his struggling with the philosophical definition of humanity. He says, but as this life is, such is the definition and knowledge of man, that is fragmentary, fleeting, and exceedingly material. The definition and knowledge about humanity will always be fragmentary. And that is not only that is not meant as an accusation against science, despite the fact that Luther had very bad experience with science, especially with medicine. But that's another problem. It is not meant as a limitation of science. No, science has to do what science can do. But it shows that despite everything we can know about ourselves, we need to know where we come from and where we go to. And that is a part of theology. That is the task of theological anthropology. And therefore, and I cannot go through all the Caesars, therefore, Luther says, if we understand man, humanity, in relation with God, we begin to understand where we came from and where we go to. And we understand the purpose of our life not only as something which is fulfilled in itself. And everybody will probably agree that there is a certain knowledge that we cannot reach fulfillment. There are maybe moments in our life, and I hope in everybody's life, are moments where we know that there is fulfillment, where we realize that fulfillment is a reality. But we know for sure, everybody knows, that we cannot reach the total fulfillment of our lives, that we have always to struggle with our imperfectness and with our imperfectness is maybe the best word for it, which is not meant unfortunately, we have not time to discuss the problem of sin, which does not mean that is an accusation toward humanity of sin. We could deal with that, what sin means in the definition of man, but which is the reality of our life, and which is even a reality of humanity in the paradise. And it's very interesting that in the lecture in Genesis, Martin Luther said that even in paradise there was time. It's kind of funny. He says he has a certain imagination how all the things went there in paradise. It all happened in one day, and the fall, of course, happened shortly after lunch, because everything was a bit drowsy and they were not fully aware, Adam and Eve were not fully aware about the dangers around themselves, and so they fall. But besides this, that this is a funny story, it is important that Luther imagines even the paradise as a thing in time. And time means limitation of humanity. The realization of time tells us that we have only a certain time and not all the time. That we are in a process. that we are going from one time to another time in our lives. So, to understand humanity, the first thing theologians have to say as anthropologists is that humanity is imperfect reality, and that is good. That is not something we have to worry about, because there is perfectness beside ourselves. We don't need to be perfect because there is perfectness beside ourselves. We could discuss now because later, 200 years later, this approach was used by a very famous German philosopher called Feuerbach to accuse theology and Christianity to project the longing for perfectness on God, the longing for the own perfectness. But the bell is ringing, and we cannot deal with it. I'm sorry, I lost a bit of time. I don't know where. Maybe it's a good thing just to end, and as all anthropology, it is always an open question, and therefore it is an open ending, and we will see what we will deal with that next tomorrow. Thank you.